C1PR. Number 26B.
Well, let me go now and just have a look at the whole chapter on prayer. And just try to find out some of the main aspects which we should never let go as we go when we go on. And that some of the main pillars of this prayer is rooted firmly in our mentality and in our heart. First of all, if we consider the chapter on prayer, we see it is the first chapter of the textbook. But where does the textbook stand in the whole spiritual development? Well, the textbook comes after the Bible. And the Bible is the forerunner and preparing the way for the textbook. It is to see that the textbook can't stand alone and by itself, that it needs the Bible. Why? Well, the Bible in the Old Testament was presenting the Word of God. It was first telling to the unillumined sense that there is a God. That there is a God, and that there is one God and the only God. And so, through the Old Testament, the reader learns the fact that there is a God, and he learns how God spake, and God spoke to, and spoke to Abraham, to Jacob, to Moses, and to the prophets, and to the kings, and so on. It's the Word of God that spoke. And so the reader, little by little, gets the firm conviction that there is a God, that there is a standard of reality which is governing the universe. Then came the New Testament with Jesus Christ, showing that man can be one with God. That there is a unity between God and the universe. That a unity between God and man. And he exemplified the fact of that unity. He exemplified it to the nth degree that God is not somewhere in heaven above, but that God is a never-present reality of which man can get hold of. And so we get the attitude of Jesus, who always stood on the point that I and the Father are one, and that he couldn't do anything which he didn't see the Father do, and that he can't do anything out of himself but only can do what he sees the Father do also. See, he presented the unity. That was the big step forward. Now that ushered in Christianity, where through 2,000 years people began to get hold of that unity and tried to use that unity to their best knowledge, through the knowledge which was based on doctrines and therefore based on belief. It may have been blind belief, it may have been holy belief, may have been emotional belief, but it was trying in some measure to use that unity, to use that possible, that possibility to get hold of God and to be one with God, to be in a relationship to God. Until Mrs. Eddy came and gave to that infant Christianity, to that emotional, religious Christianity, a scientific touch. And that's the textbook. So the textbook comes in at the point of Christianity and science, giving a scientific explanation of Christianity against that 2,000-year-old emotional, religious Christianity. And so the textbook can only come in to a man when he has, to some extent, got hold of the Bible, of the Old Testament, the fact that there is a God and one God, and that that one God is a spirit, and has got hold in some measure that he can be one with that God, that he can approach that God, and that he can use this unity and oneness. Then comes the textbook and comes to the reader and says, yes, that's all right, but you were fishing in the dark, and sometimes you caught a fish and usually you didn't catch a fish. I come and tell you the scientific way. So the textbook builds already on the Bible, and therefore doesn't start as the Bible starts by presenting first that there is a God and that this God speaks to men. But the textbook starts at the point of Christianity in its science, therefore it's science and health, science and Christianity, the science of the health, the science of the healthy, whole manhood. At that point, the textbook starts and talks right to men and explains to men his scientific approach to God. What we therefore will experience in going through the textbook is the birth, the new birth of manhood. It isn't so much, really, the birth of a new concept of God. The Bible has given that. Therefore we find it in the Bible, and therefore Mrs. Eddy found it in the Bible. It may have been veiled, all right, but it was there. The textbook comes at the point of manhood and shows the birth of true spiritual scientific manhood. And therefore, as we live through these chapters, what must happen if we are sincere and honest about it and gentle and loving about it, what must happen with us is that we are born anew. We won't get a new concept of God which the Bible didn't have. That is reiterated in the textbook. It's the same God. But what we will find is the scientific way of the new birth of manhood. And therefore it speaks right at the beginning to men and about men, what man should be, what his attitude should be, that he should have a desire for God, that he should long and strive for God and so on. You see, the textbook right begins right with qualities of manhood, and not so much with explaining and arguing is there a God or isn't there a God? There is no argumentation and no long discussion about the question if there is a God or if there isn't a God. There is no long argumentation what this God is and what it isn't. In the first subject in prayer, we already have that wonderful sense, well, God is mind, he knows already all. God is spirit, he is the infinite blessing. God is soul, he is unchangeable. God has a science, he is a principle. God is life, he gives already all than what we expect. God is truth, he is right, and he does right, we don't have to remind of him. God is love, his work is done. You see, the textbook starts right with the whole substance of the Bible. And it takes that as a known fact. That's why Mr. Dole is so often pointed out that only the Bible leads us really to the textbook. That's why we have so often said that we can't have one book without the other. That's why we have so often said that really the Bible and the love of the Bible and seeing the Bible in its ordered story is really that which cultures our tone and prepares us until we are receptive for a scientific birth in the text. So, don't think that because I speak only of the textbook, and this whole series of talks is on the subject of the textbook, that I neglect the Bible, or I think that the Bible is not so important. I only expect that the Bible has been digested to a certain extent. Then we ripen to the stage where the textbook can speak to man and say to man, I take you now through the birth, and I lead you through 16 chapters to build up true manhood. True manhood. Until in the 16th chapter you behold your unity of the Lamb, the Bride and the Lamb, principle and idea. But in order to come to that point, the textbook says, I lead you gently, step by step, through the text, through the textbook, through the chapter. So, there is where we start. Now, the chapter on prayer. We were wondering what real big issue the chapter on prayer is answering really. If we see that the 16 chapters build up the 16 cornerstones of manhood, true manhood, and therefore is building up those 16 important points of being, then every one of these 16 chapters must somehow answer a leading question of manhood. And the question I think we find here answered is the answer to the question which you put to yourself so often and which you hear so often, namely, I think it is the question, well, here we are on this earth, let's get something out of life. Let's get something out of life. Let's get something. But how? And then come all the problems of life which say, well, I don't get so much out of life as I would like to. It's that where we feel all my endeavors in life don't give me what I want to get. Or all my good intentions which I had don't give me what I wanted to receive. And one of the first and biggest questions of manhood is, what is life? What is the content of life? How can I make life successful? And I think prayer is the answer to that big question. You may come to another solution. That would be very interesting to know. But let's just try to feel our way. That chapter must answer one of the leading questions of every man and woman on this earth. And it seems that it is the question which we have so often, how to get. How to get something in life. How to get most out of life. And naturally the answer is that without giving we won't get. And that without giving the right thing we won't get the right thing. And that therefore we can make a success of life by giving the right thing. And so this prayer seems to open up a vista which is broad and wide, because it is so necessary for our whole life, because we live a whole life and we want that life to be satisfying and a success. And the question is, but how? But how? And prayer is praying for a reward. And we have seen that we have that reward, what we give. That first we have to give, and if we give the right thing, we get the right thing. Our prayers are answered. And the chapter on prayer therefore defines what we have to give in order to get. What we have to give in our whole life, from morning, noon, night, in order to get real life, a successful life, a satisfying life, a worthwhile life, a Christian life. And prayer comes and says, well, therefore, your life is really, must be really one prayer, namely, your life is devoting yourself to God, consecrating yourself to God, dedicating yourself to God. I don't know if you can say in English, I would say hallowing yourself to God. That's our life. That's where our life starts, and that's where we get real life. If we have that sense of these seven prayers, which all of the seven prayers really give the best of manhood to God, the best qualities of manhood to God, to the allness of God and the isness of God, and the unchangeability of God and the infinitude of God. If we give that, such prayer is answered in bigness, in a big life, in a spiritually measured big life, not in a worldly measured big life. Now, you know so well that so often thinking, good, fine people just ask this big question. Why am I living here? For what I am living here? How should I live to live? How should I live and what should I do in order to have life? And prayer seems to me to be the answer to this big question. To give what belongs to God. And to give it fully and wholly and completely and unrestrictedly, and then I have life. Now the beauty of this chapter is that it defines clearly and scientifically how to do that. In the infant religious Christianity of the last 2,000 years, people didn't know how to consecrate their lives to God. They tried to consecrate their lives to God by going to a monastery, or by going to the Red Cross, or by going to church, or by going doing this and doing that. And now comes science and health and says, God is a principle, and therefore dedicating oneself to God means dedicating oneself to a divine principle. And through seven stages depicts how to do that. And so we are sitting here as the most happy people who after 2,000 years know the way. And millions have lived before who couldn't know the way. And we shouldn't be happy. And we shouldn't feel grateful. And we shouldn't feel being loved. To have that honor, to be chosen. Why should we ever be unhappy again? We shouldn't. We should feel very, 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 very honored that God has chosen us and given us the way. Here we sit. We know the way. We have one principle. And she showed that there is one principle of prayer. Therefore, one approach to prayer, not many approaches. That there is one object of prayer, namely the wholeness of God. That there are seven definite means to approach that one God. Seven spiritual means of God to approach Him. That there is one big need, and not many material needs, one big need to grow in grace, to get in line with God. We know the need. And we know the reward. And we don't expect a reward which God can't give. We only expect the reward which God can give, and God can only give what He has. His nature of mind and of spirit and soul, principle and life and truth and love. And so we get free from that false sense of prayer which thinks, for every specific problem I have, I need another prayer and I need to pray differently and I must do something else. And do I know what to do for this problem? Do I know what to do for that problem? It just says, no, your start is just finely, divinely defined. Go and start right. Start with the bigness and allness of God and pray of that Godness, of that allness. So we are no more in doubt how to pray. Think of the beauty of it. That we don't wander anymore in darkness. That we have seen the light and know the light and know the way and can go the way. We know now to pray. There is no more doubt about it. We know now what it needs. That it needs that unself-love. And we see that this one prayer is a divine institution, and not just a theological, ritualistic, or dogmatic institution. It's a divine institution, and it's open for all, for black and white people, for Buddhists and Jews and Christians. It's open for Roman Catholics and Protestants and even Christian Scientists. They mostly have the most difficulty because they are so preconceived. But it's open to all. It has nothing religious about it. It is not bound to any religion. It's not bound to anything, to no nation, to no time, to no race, to no color, to nothing. That's the sense of science. Everyone who has accepted the facts of the Bible, no matter if he's Jew or Christian or Buddhist or what it is, or if he is just a good thinker, he can approach God. Now, what we have seen is another point of import. Namely, I pointed out time and time again, and I want to make a point of it for the last time, but it is the important point, namely, that the chapter on prayer and the real prayer is never concerned primarily, I say primarily, to get the specific answer to a specific problem. Primarily, it is concerned with worshipping the root of divinity, the foundation of divinity, God as he is. That's the first and prayer, the big prayer, the one wonderful big prayer. The human mind wants to have it the other way around. It wants to have first, it determines first what it wants, second, how it should come about, and thirdly, perhaps it judges if it has been worked out right or wrong. But that is not prayer in a Christian scientific way. In a Christian scientific way, we are not doing that. We are not designing what we should need and what we should get and how we should get. We must give the Christ a chance. We must give God and his Christ a chance. And we must go with an unpreconceived, with an open thought to the allness of God, and let God determine what we need and give us in the way he wants us to give, and give us what he wants us to give and when he wants us to give. That's God's job and God's concern, and we should not interfere with God's government. What we have to do is to approach God right. That's the point. That's prayer. To approach him as he is, in the right way as he is. And because you know from your experience, just as I know, how your friends or pupils or whatever they are, how when they are in a difficulty, what they call a difficulty, that they say what is right and what is wrong. They say it's only right that I should get this and this. It's only right that it should work out so and so. It's only right. Who says so? Who is God? I? Can I define what is only right? I can't. And dealing with patients, you find, I'm sure you find that difficulty time and time and time again, that they have closed their thought to their own need, their own concept of what they need, to their own concept of what is right, to their own concept how it should work out. Time and time again. And I can tell them time and time again, say, well, first, let's be clear what is right. Let's first go to God. But they say, well, it's only right that I get this and this. It's only right that it should happen so and so. It's only right and so on. See, we don't give Christ a chance with this attitude. We don't give him a chance. It's the power of positive thinking that comes in. That's all there is. But no Christianity and no salvation. Therefore, let's never forget this chapter on prayer. That this chapter on prayer gives no answer how to pray for a specific problem. This chapter on prayer is naturally something else than the chapter on Christian Science practice. Quite something different. But to start right, we must start with the chapter on prayer. In the chapter on Christian Science practice, there then the whole method of uncovering is shown, how it uncovers a specific evil and how that specific evil is handled. But we will see then there that that uncovering is only possible because the mentality of the practitioner has to that extent acquired the atmosphere of the chapter on prayer that the Christ speaks through his spiritual sense and uncovers what needs to be uncovered.